Marjorie drew a capital letter between my shoulder blades with her finger. Guess the letter.
M.
I was uncannily good at the back letter drawing game, even in a state of emotional cataclysm. I shouldn't have said all that stuff to you, but I was very upset that you told Mom on me. I thought we were sisters and that we had secrets.
E.
How would you like it if I told Mom you came up here pawing my boobs, feeling me up?
H.
It wasn't H. I was flustered. I didn't know what she meant by feeling her up, but I knew her telling Mom about it wouldn't be good.
No.
She drew the letter on my back again, moving slower, adding more pressure.
R.
Yes. What if I told Mom that you were teasing me, spying on me, following me around, generally making me crazy? I know she told you that you're supposed to be nice to me, to help out.
R. I'm sorry about your boobs. Please don't tell Mom on me.
I won't tell if you won't tell.
Okay. Why? Mary.
She'd written an easy word on my back to calm me down. It worked. I wasn't crying anymore, but my eyes felt heavier than ever. Then we have a deal, Miss Mary. Marjorie rubbed her hand over my back like a teacher erasing a blackboard, and she started writing again.
Gee.
So that song you heard me humming, it just sort of popped into my head.
L.
The song. The reason why I'd come up the stairs. Marjorie hummed it again. It sounded even sadder up close.
Oh, and oh. Did you make it up?
Yes and yes and no. It's a real song.
M.
Mom and Dad don't listen to it. I know I haven't heard it anywhere, like I said, just like the stories. I woke up one morning and it was just sitting there in my head.
Why?
It sounds so sad, doesn't it? Like a song about the saddest day ever.
S.
But when I hum it, it tickles something behind my throat, and it feels sort of good.
V?
Not V. Sometimes it's good to be sad, Mary. Don't forget that. Marjorie didn't repeat the letter I'd missed, but moved on to a new one. The new letter had two slow vertical lines that walked up and then down the length of my back, and one hard diagonal slash to connect them.
N.
Yes. It's weird, but I even know the lyrics, too.
D. Sing it.
I only asked her to sing the words because I knew she wanted me to ask. I didn't really want to hear the words. I was afraid that if she sang it, it'd be about a sister stealing another sister's tongue.
I don't feel like singing the lyrics. I like humming it. A.
I like keeping the words to myself.
Why?
You wouldn't like the lyrics anyway. She stopped drawing on my back. So I'll just keep humming it. Maybe I'll hum it to you in your sleep.
Marjorie!
She laughed and tickled my armpits. I didn't laugh. I gave her a quick, high-pitched whine and a snort.
Stop!
Stay there. Don't move. She hummed the song as she stood up on the love seat. I bounced around the cushion as she shifted and adjusted her balance. She swayed over my head like the branches of a willow tree in a storm. I felt the weight of the song, its minor key squeezing the air out of my chest. Marjorie jumped off, flying above my head. I ducked and rolled back into the loveseat cushions as her shadow passed over me. She landed loudly and her knees buckled, pitching her almost straight into a window. Somewhere down below us, my father shouted,
"What the hell was that?"
Marjorie said, "My dismount needs work. Practice makes perfect, right?" She pinched my belly and then ran out of the room and into her bedroom with me yelling, "Stop it!" after her. Marjorie still hummed the song in her room. I sat, listening, and then I hummed along with that simple but heartbreaking melody. I dangled a foot in one of the sunroom's fading sunbeams. I wondered if I would still be able to hum the song when I didn't have a tongue. I decided that I would. Chapter 12. On our TV show, the following is presented as a dramatic reenactment and as the penultimate piece of evidence regarding Marjorie being possessed by an evil spirit. The reenactment is a raw and undeniably effective set piece full of disorienting jump cuts, an ominous, if not over-the-top, voiceover narrative, and what I have to assume were some low-level CGI special effects along with digitally altered enhanced sound. In the scene, the Barrett family actors lounge in the living room, watching Finding Bigfoot. Everyone in the room happily watches some pseudoscientist bellow his Bigfoot call into a night-vision-enhanced forest. Actor Mom, plain, dash of freckles, very pretty, even for TV, and actor Dad, too heavy and too old to be our dad, and his beard was as patchy as a summer-burnt lawn, sit next to each other on the couch, each wearing button-down shirts and wrinkle-free pants. Both Barrett children actors are on the floor, lying on their stomachs, cheeks in fists, feet dangling in the air, heels knocking into each other. This 21st-century Rockwell scene of quaint familial tranquility quickly devolves when actor Dad asks,
"So, how did school go today?"
The ensuing tornado is not to be contained to the living room, but instead cuts a swath through the house until everything finally culminates and crashes in Marjorie's bedroom. It just didn't happen that way. But I must admit that I was once obsessed with the show Finding Bigfoot and would insist that everyone in the family watch the show with me. I'd also have playful arguments all the time with Dad about the existence or non-existence of Bigfoot. I was the believer, and he was not. The unspoken ground rule of our ongoing debate was that neither of us was ever going to change our minds. I was fervent in my belief that the mythical beast was real, and I would practically spit on any suggestions to the contrary. While I know he enjoyed the give and take, Dad remained coolly rational and scientific in his approach to our arguments. Using the Socratic method of Sasquatch debunking, he'd ask me questions, thinking I'd eventually hit upon the truth. His go-to question, particularly when I'd filibustered my way through previous questions about population density or evolution or ecosystem sustainability, was why had no one ever found the body of a dead Bigfoot? Well, of course, it was because they buried their dead and buried them in secret, sacred places. Duh, Dad. I don't remember us being in the living room that night watching Finding Bigfoot, nor do I remember the incident happening there. However, I could be misremembering. Maybe how our TV show presented the living room scene was, save a few dramatic embellishments, how it actually happened. The writers and producers contractually consulted Mom and Dad, and consulted them extensively. Maybe the show relied on Marjorie and whatever it was she told them during their numerous interviews. To my recollection, no one asked me about that night. It's possible that night was such a traumatic experience that I've blocked it, or have somehow conflated the general unreality of our show with what actually happened. What I remember is us eating dinner at the kitchen table, sitting at our four points on the compass. We were contemplative and quiet, unsure of what was happening, unsure of what to do, even after it ended. I'll always remember the four of us sitting around the kitchen table, placed like dolls at an imaginary tea party. The Barrett women wordlessly agreed that we weren't waiting for Dad and started eating our pasta. Yes, pasta again for the third night in a row. I'd complained when I'd found Mom boiling water in the big pea-green pot. She'd told me that we could no longer afford to be picky at dinner. I'd walked out of the kitchen, slumped and groaning about how I'd turn into Spaghetti Girl if I ate any more of it. I'd wiggled my arms around bonelessly as a brief demonstration of the not-so-awesome powers of Spaghetti Girl. Our small kitchen table didn't seem as small because our table setting was so depressingly Spartan. No colander in the middle overflowing with tentacles of extra spaghetti. No glass bowl of red sauce. No cutting board with sliced chunks of garlic bread. No side bowls with sparkling green and red salads. Not that I would have eaten a full salad. My little wooden bowl would have held only little wheels of carefully peeled cucumbers and maybe a few baby carrots. What was on the table? 4 plates of spaghetti, serving sizes modest, and 4 glasses of water. I'd asked for milk, but Mom had said simply, "Drink water and quit belly aching." Dad sat at the table with his head bowed, eyes closed, and with his hands folded, those thick fingers wound tightly in between each other so that it looked like there were more fingers than there should have been. I counted the knuckles on each of his hands twice to make sure that there weren't extras. Dad prayed over his food for an uncomfortably long time. He was so focused and earnest that I felt pressured into joining him, even as I worried that I didn't know how to pray or to whom to pray. The other morning, while driving me to school, he described praying as a conversation in your head with God. Happy that he was even talking to me, as he'd been borderline unresponsive since the night in Marjorie's room, I'd asked who God really was besides some big bearded old guy up in the clouds. Dad had started by saying God was love, which had sounded nice. But then he'd fumbled around a convoluted explanation involving Jesus and the Holy Spirit. I'd made a joke about my head getting too crowded with all those people to talk to instead of telling him that I didn't want to hear any more about it. Dad had made me feel terribly anxious in a way that I couldn't describe right then, partially because I couldn't be trusted to not tell Mom about his preaching and proselytizing without her permission, just like I had told on Marjorie. I'd become so very tired of other people's secrets and stories. Dad had laughed at my too crowded joke, and he'd said to just give it a try sometime, that it'd make me feel better. I gently placed my fork down and folded my hands like Dad. Before I could say anything to the people in my head, I caught Marjorie watching me from the inside of her hooded sweatshirt. She smirked and shook her head no. I quickly picked my fork back up and imagined Bigfoot crashing through the woods behind our house and into the kitchen, destroying everything. Mom refused to look at Dad while he prayed. She held one hand to her forehead, shielding her eyes as though there were a glare. Eventually, he picked up his head and crossed himself, touching his forehead, chest, then each shoulder. He did it so fast, like he'd been practicing all his life. Dad smiled and looked at each of us. He gave me an extra wink. I wasn't good at winking, so I blew him a kiss in return. Marjorie made a retching sound. No one asked if she was okay, which meant something. Then she said, "Sorry, wrong pipe. Please take your hood off at the dinner table." Marjorie complied. The removal of her hood was a shocking revelation. Her skin was gray, the color of the mushrooms that grew around the snaking tangle of tree roots out back. The circles under her eyes were dark and deep. Her black hair was a dead octopus leaking and sliding off her scalp. Whiteheads dotted her chin and the sides of her nose. Dad said,
"So how was school today?"
"Oh, you know, Dad, the usual. I was voted class president, captain of the soccer team, most hottest chick ever." Mom cut in with, "Marjorie isn't feeling well. They sent her home because she got sick in the cafeteria."
"What, again? Poor kid. Do you feel good enough to eat? Why are you eating this stuff now? Sarah, don't force her to eat if she's having stomach problems."
Dad's hands were folded again, this time in front of his plate. "I'm not forcing her, John. She said she felt better, right? Hunky and dory."
"You don't look good."
"Thanks, Dad. I feel so pretty."
"You know what I mean. You know you're my beautiful girl."
He'd said it like the small print of a warranty or an indemnification clause. I said, "Hey!"
"You're my beautiful girl too, Mary."
Marjorie groaned. She wrapped a strand of spaghetti around her finger and said, "You're going to make me puke again." Under her nails were black with dirt. Had she been digging in the yard? I imagined her out back, planting growing things. Dad said,
You look pale. Maybe we should let you sleep in tomorrow.
I'll be fine. I don't want to miss any more schoolwork. They're threatening to send me to summer school already.
Marjorie rested the back of her hand on her forehead. She was in actress mode, I could tell. A hint of a British accent had slipped into her speech. I practiced eating my pasta while trying not to use my tongue. I was a planner, a considerer of every contingency.
Don't worry about that. We'll do what we have to do.
As if on cue, we all looked down at our feeble plates, our dinner metaphor for doing what we had to do. Dad then turned to me and said,
Mary, tell us how your day was. I'd like to hear about one good thing that happened and one thing that made you laugh.
Always pleased to have the family spotlight thrust upon me, I said, Well, elongating the word by vibrating the tip of my tongue against the back of my front teeth.
We started reading Charlie and the Chocolate Factory in class. Ronnie made me laugh when he pretended to be Augustus Gloop drinking from the chocolate river. He got down on his hands and knees and acted like he was licking the rug. He shouted, Chocolate, that's good.
I demonstrated with my impression of Ronnie's funny German accent.
Mrs. Hulbig didn't think he was funny, though.
Mom said, interesting. He's probably seen that horrible Johnny Depp version of the movie. That you kids like it and not the original Gene Wilder version is sacrilege.
Mom, what's your problem?
I said, talking and acting like Depp's version of Wonka. Vacant smile, creepy voice full of air and lisp and nothing else. Dad said,
That's pretty good. I have to admit, you're good at doing voices, Mary.
I am?
Both Mom and Marjorie groaned.
Yes, you've always been great at doing impressions and funny little voices.
I changed my pitch and tone with each word.
I can do voices.
Just great. She'll be doing voices all night now, Marjorie said.
I can do voices.
Mom said, You have no idea what you started, do you? I cackled in two or three different styles, then stopped abruptly.
Oh, Mom, I almost forgot. Tomorrow is hat day in school. I need to find a hat. What hat should I wear?
I don't know. We'll look for a hat after dinner. Dad said,
Hey, you can wear my Red Sox hat.
Gross, no way.
I instinctively covered my head with my hands. Legend foretold of a hat that was older than Marjorie and had never been washed. The once white sweatband ringing the inside of his hat was black. The red B was all grimy-looking, and the bill was sweat-stained and misshapen. Dad used to chase us around with the hat, trying to put it on our heads. We'd run away laughing and screaming. The game had usually ended when I'd whine and complain that he was chasing Marjorie more than he was chasing me. It was true, but to be fair, Marjorie was more fun to chase because she was harder to catch. Even though I was fast, I'd give up and stop running, drop to the ground, and roll into a ball. Dad would quickly put the hat on my head, but in 2 seconds he'd be off again, playfully shouting and chasing after Marjorie. Her taunts were always so clever, and if he caught her, she'd get it worse. He'd rub the hat all over her head and face until her repeated, Dad, stop it! Sounded angry. Sitting at the kitchen table that night, those hat chases seemed like they'd happened eons ago, although the last time we'd done it was only a few months prior at a Labor Day barbecue. During that chase, Dad had knocked over a small folding table, spilling paper plates and plastic utensils. Mom said, We don't want the school to send her home for lice, John. It was supposed to be a joke, but it had an edge to it. I said,
I want to wear something funny and cool. Marjorie, could I wear your sparkly baseball hat?
The three of us looked at Marjorie. Now I remember thinking that her answer could change everything back to the way it was. Dad could find a job and stop praying all the time, and Mom could be happy and call Marjorie shellfish again and show us funny videos she found on YouTube, and we could all eat more than just spaghetti at dinner and, most important, Marjorie could be normal again.
Everything would be okay if Marjorie would only say yes to me wearing the sparkly sequined baseball hat, the one she'd made in art class a few years ago. The longer we watched Marjorie and waited for a response, the more the temperature in the room dropped, and I knew that nothing would ever be the same again. She stopped twisting her spaghetti around her fingers. She opened her mouth, and vomit slowly oozed out onto her spaghetti plate. Dad.
Jesus.
Mom.
Honey, are you okay?
She jumped out of her seat and went over to Marjorie, stood behind her, and held her hair up. Marjorie didn't react to either parent, and she didn't make any sounds. She wasn't retching or convulsing involuntarily like one normally does when throwing up. It just poured out of her, as though her mouth was an opened faucet. The vomit was as green as spring grass, and the masticated pasta looked weirdly dry, with a consistency of mashed-up dog food. She watched Dad the whole time as the vomit filled her plate, some of it slopping over the edges and onto the table. When she finished, she wiped her mouth on her sleeve.
"No, Mary, you can't wear my hat."
She didn't sound like herself. Her voice was lower, adult, and growly.
"You might get something on it. I don't want you to mess it up."
She laughed. "Dad."
"Marjorie."
Marjorie coughed and vomited more onto her too full plate.
"You can't wear the hat because you're going to die someday."
She found a new voice, this one a treacly baby talk.
"I don't want dead things wearing my very special hat."
Mom backed away from Marjorie and bumped into my chair. I reached out and clung to her hip with my right arm and covered my mouth with my left. A third new voice, genderless and nasally.
"No one here can wear it because you're all going to die."
"Marjorie."
Dad stayed in his seat and held out a hand to her.
"Marjorie, look at me. Hold my hand and pray with me, please. Just try it."
Mom was crying and shaking her head. Convinced that he was only going to make it all worse, I squeaked out, "Leave her alone," then covered my mouth back up quickly because it wasn't safe to talk. He said in his most patient voice, which seemed to be not his voice at all, as alien as the voices coming from my sister,
"Marjorie is never alone. He is always with her. Let us pray to him."
And I started crying, too, because I was afraid and confused. I thought that Dad was saying there was someone inside Marjorie and that he wanted to pray to him. Dad pushed back his chair and knelt on the floor.
"Okay, Dad."
Marjorie slid out of her chair, leaking down toward the floor, and disappeared under the table. Mom left me and bent down next to Marjorie's chair. "Sweetie, come out from under there. I'll run you a nice warm bath upstairs, okay? Let's go to bed early. You'll feel better." She kept cooing promises of hope and healing. Now I was alone, with my hand still over my mouth. Marjorie slunk and slid on the hardwood somewhere in the depths beneath the table. I could not see her and pulled my dangling feet up onto the chair. My toes curled inside the sneakers. We waited and watched. Dad suddenly jolted as if given an electric shock and knocked into the table, shaking our plates and forks and spilling more vomit off of Marjorie's plate, which smelled of acid and dirt. Marjorie's hand reached up. Her skin was ash gray, and her dirty fingernails were as black as fish eyes. Then her muddy voice echoed up from the bottom of a well.
"Go ahead, Dad. Take my hand."
He slowly reached out and did as she asked. She pulled his hand beneath the table to where we couldn't see. Dad was a statue bust, as cold and white as marble. He started a prayer.
"In the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, please, Lord, give Marjorie strength."
He paused and seemed unsure of what exactly to say, as though he knew he was an amateur, a poser, a fraud.
To help her deal with the affliction she's struggling with, cleanse her spirit, show her the...
Then he screamed in pain. The table rattled again as he pulled his arm out from under the table. The back of his hand was bleeding, had been slashed open. There were two deep red lines dousing a path toward his wrist. He clutched the hand to his chest instinctively, then held it out toward Mom in an expression of childlike fear and incredulity at the unfairness of it all. Mom, did she scratch you? Bite you?
Maybe. I don't know.
I scooted back in my chair, convinced that Marjorie would come for me next and drag me down beneath the surface and into the shadows, pry my mouth open for its pink, wriggling worm. Marjorie hummed her terrible song and crawled away from the table. Her hood was covering her hair. She stopped humming and spouted gibberish that I tried to spell inside my head, but it was made out of nothing but angry consonants. My parents both said her name, saying it like her name was a question, and a call, and a plea. Marjorie slowly crawled away from the light of the kitchen and into the dark of the dining room.
"I don't bite or scratch," she said in another voice, a new one, one that didn't sound like anyone who had ever spoken before in the human history of speech. "He scraped the back of his hand on the rusty metal and bolts under the old table."
She slipped into more of the consonant speak and then added,
"We always hurt ourselves, don't we? I'm going to my room. No visitors, please."
Marjorie hummed the song again, changing pitch and timbre so quickly and abruptly it was disorienting, and it felt like my ears were popping. She crawled through the dining room, moving like a monitor lizard or something as equally ancient, and into the front foyer and to the stairs. She said from far away, "I can do voices too, Mary." Chapter 13. Another Saturday morning. Everything in the house felt dead, even though I had no idea at that time what death felt like. Mom had gone back to bed after making me a bowl of cereal for breakfast. Rice Krispies. She hadn't put in the usual 2 spoonfuls of sugar, and there wasn't enough milk left to sufficiently soak the mouthy, complaining Krispies. I hadn't dared complain, though. Mom had had the look. I ate until there was only a semi-mushy paste of cereal spackled to the bottom of the plastic bowl. We didn't have any orange juice either, so I drank water. I had the TV to myself and watched all the Finding Bigfoots I'd saved to the DVR. Earlier that week, my parents had said something about watching everything on the DVR before it had to be disconnected, so I was proud to accomplish that, at least. Around episode 4, with the crew of squatchers somewhere in the woods of Vermont, Dad shuffled down the stairs and into the kitchen. He sighed at the empty milk carton on the table, muttered swears that weren't quite under his breath, and slammed around the kitchen looking for breakfast. He settled on defrosting an English muffin. When he came into the living room with his peanut butter-slathered muffin, he wordlessly took the remote control from me and flipped over to one of our many sports channels. I hated watching sports and suggested compromise viewing, a show called River Monsters, which featured a charismatic British angler with terrible teeth who traveled to exotic lakes and rivers to catch giant catfish and these living torpedoes called arapaimas. Dad refused to compromise. I patiently waited until he was done with his breakfast, and then I jumped into his lap saying,
"Dad, play with me. Catch me. You can't catch me."
I bent down and pulled his folded legs out straight and away from the couch.
"Come on, the alligator game."
The alligator game. His legs were the jaws of the alligator, and I'd dance in, around, and between them, teasing the gator into snapping its jaws shut on me. Dad did as he was asked, but it was obvious his heart wasn't in it, that he was still preoccupied. I was manic in my attempt to have fun. If I danced fast enough, if I laughed heartily enough, if I shrieked loud enough when caught, maybe he'd forget about Marjorie for a moment. His alligator mouth was too sluggish. He missed repeatedly. I pleaded with him to try harder. Then he blamed me for his own lack of motivation and purpose. He said,
"Well, you stop being a chicken. You can't dance in and out from there. You're too far away. You have to come closer to me. You stand there longer."
When he still couldn't catch me, he criticized how I was jumping in his coach voice. He said that I was too flat-footed, too heavy on my feet, that I had to be on the tips of my toes, that I should walk light enough that he couldn't hear my feet on the floor. I humored him, even though I wanted to drop to the floor in a boneless heap and weave myself into the fibers of the throw rug, to disappear under everyone's feet and to be forgotten. I danced on my toes until they cramped while he half-heartedly opened and closed his outstretched legs in weak attempts to catch me. Desperate, I escalated my attack, smacking and pinching his legs. It worked. Dad lunged off the couch with a fierceness and power that was as exhilarating as it was frightening, and he grabbed my arms and pulled me into him. He tickled me and rubbed his coarse beard on my cheeks while I giggled and screamed for him to stop. He stopped too quickly and let me slide off him, thudding to the floor.
"Ow, Dad!"
"Sorry. Look, I'm trying to watch TV. Go upstairs and see what Mommy is doing."
I tried going after his legs again, but he crossed them and said,
"Seriously, stop bugging me."
"Fine." I ran up the stairs on my toes as quietly as I could. "Thank you, Coach Dad." I stopped at the top of the stairs and pressed up against the wall opposite the banister. I slowly peeked around the corner and saw Marjorie's door was shut. I did not want her to hear me. I'd been avoiding being alone with her since the sunroom incident. The hallway was dark and the old brass-plated push-button light switch was right next to my face. Nose to nose with my distorted reflection in the brass, I didn't press the little black button, thinking it was best not to change or disturb anything up here. I considered going back downstairs and trying to get Dad to play with me again, or sulking next to him quietly on the couch. My room was too far away, at the other end of the yawning chasm of hallway. The bathroom door, which was adjacent to Marjorie's room, was also shut, but inside the fan was on, running roughly, revving, then slowing like a lawnmower about to run out of gas. Marjorie had been spending more and more time in the bathroom, usually with the fan on, sometimes with the sink running water, much to Dad's consternation. Water wasn't free, you know. I relaxed. Marjorie wouldn't hear me creeping in the hallway. The fan was too loud. Instead of the long walk and then barricading myself in my room, I bounded across the hall to Mom's and threw open her door. I said,
"Dad said I should see what you're doing."
Fully knowing that Mom would be mad at Dad for sending me up there to bother her when he should be watching and/or playing with me. The comforter and sheets had been kicked off the foot of my parents' bed. Mom wasn't in the room. Marjorie was. She sat propped up against the headboard with pillows folded and stuffed behind her back. Her breathing was shallow but rapid, and she grunted, snarled, sighed, a sputtering engine, the dying fan in our bathroom. Her head was thrown back, chin pointed at the ceiling, as sharp as the tip of an umbrella, eyes closed so tight like she was hiding them deep inside her head. She had on a too small black T-shirt, tight enough to outline her ribcage. No pants. No underwear. Her hands were between her long, skinny, pale legs. Both hands, and they gyrated up and down, making wet sounds. I didn't know what to do. I just stood there and watched. I wanted to yell, "What are you doing? I don't know what you're doing." Even though I did know this secret that wasn't a secret. I felt myself flush, turning red on the outside and white on the inside, and then vice versa. I didn't exactly feel sick to my stomach. The feeling was lower and deeper. Her hands moved faster, and she grew louder, and I didn't want anyone else in the house to hear her, so I quietly said, "Shh," and thought about shutting the door, but I couldn't. I was afraid to look at her hands and look between her legs, but I still leaned hard to my right, peering around the hard corner of her knees and thighs. Marjorie rocked in place. Her entire body moved in rhythm with her frantically working hands. She opened her mouth and released a deep sigh. Politely peering wasn't enough. I tiptoed down to the foot of the bed, and with the new vantage, I saw that her hands were red with dark blood, and so was the white sheet beneath, and so was between her legs. I ran out of the room, stumbling into the hallway, and banged on the bathroom door. "Mom! Mom! Something's wrong with Marjorie! She's bleeding!" I tried shouting directly into the wood of the door. I didn't want Dad to hear me. Mom couldn't hear me over the fan and yelled back, "What? Just give me a sec. I'll be out in a minute." I turned, and Marjorie was in the hallway behind me, perched precariously on her impossibly thin legs, back arched up against the wall, her body a new punctuation mark. One hand still manipulated herself, the other left red smears on the wallpaper. She panted and spoke the same gibberish made of rocks and broken glass that she'd spoken that night in the kitchen. Her eyes opened and then rolled into the back of her head, showing off those horrible bright whites with their convoluted red maps. She laughed, groaned, and said in a small, tight whisper, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God." Then something that might have been nonsense, or it might have been, "I can still hear them." She stopped talking, and she grunted loudly, like she'd just taken a punch to the gut. Her body shook, and she urinated and defecated right there in the hallway. The smell of shit, blood, and piss was overpowering, and I tasted pennies in my mouth. She slid down the wall and sat in her own puddle, rubbing her hands on the floor, herself, and the walls. I screamed for Mom to please help, to please let me in. I closed my eyes and I hung on the doorknob, turning it with both hands. The bathroom door shook and rattled in its frame. Mom was yelling now, too, sensing my panic on the outside. Dad bellowed our names from down below, those powerless one-word prayers for peace. And he thundered up the stairs, shaking the railing and banisters, sundering the house beneath him, sounding like the end of the world. Part 2. Chapter 14. The Last Final Girl.
Yeah, it's just a blog. How retro. Or is The Last Final Girl the greatest blog ever? Exploring all things horror and horrific. Books, comics, video games, TV, movies, high school, strike that. From the gooey gory midnight show cheese to the highfalutin art house highbrow, beware of spoilers, I will spoil you. Bio, Karen Brissett. Tuesday, November 15th, 2000. The Possession, 15 Years Later, Episode 1, Part 2. All right, let's dig into the first episode, shall we? We shall. First, a quick addendum, important follow-up point to the previous blog post about the show's opening. Besides serving as the patriarchal breakdown theme of the show, as I already discussed in great detail, the show's opening explains, without having to spell it out for everyone, how a family would possibly consider allowing a network to broadcast their living nightmare, a teenage daughter going through a particularly nasty, devastating psychotic break while believing, or pretending, yeah, she was possessed by a demon, and a stereotypical demon at that. Let me say it simply. The Barretts were about to default on their mortgage and lose the house. They needed cash, and quick. The show's producers paid them that quick cash for their televised pounds of flesh. Aside one, Sixth Finger Productions was a new company headed by Randy Francis, who was a 20-something venture capitalist. Thanks for the money, Dad. Give me more. And who has since carved out a niche producing direct-to-video fantasy flicks that rip off J.K. Rowling, George R.R. Martin, J.R.R. Tolkien, and other fantasy writers with initials in their names. How Sixth Finger heard of the Barrett story, how they knew to swoop in and offer financial salvation, and exactly where all the money came from before the Discovery Channel became involved is still a bit of a mystery. Father David Wanderley, the priest who befriended John Barrett, is the clear go-between for the Barretts and the production company. However, rumors of Wanderley's involvement with conservative PACs, their monies being rerouted to the production, backroom deals with the Archdiocese to keep his parish's church from closing, and rich and powerful and mustache-twisting Opus Dei members ominously being involved are all iffy hearsay at best, as far as little old me can tell. I've found both unauthorized accounts of the show, To Hell and Back, The Real Story Behind the Possession and Possession Lies in Videotape, The Dark Angels Behind the Possession, lacking in the How the Show Came to Be department, and frankly, poorly written overall. Yes, I said that. Okay, enough of that. For realsies this time, let's get to it. To the it. To the fictional possession of poor Marjorie Barrett, age 14. After the intro, the bulk of the pilot is a string of reenactments and sets of interviews with the parents and Father Wanderley. If the intro was the opening argument about what was at stake for the soul of family values and patriarchy in America, the meat of the pilot was the show laying out their evidence of Marjorie's possession by an evil spirit, entity, sprite, demon, impish ne'er-do-well. The story they present sounds a tad familiar, yeah? That's because it should. The Exorcist, the movie directed by William Friedkin, based on the novel by William Peter Blatty, is a 1970s cultural touchstone and phenomenon. Admittedly, it has lost some of its punch, its visceral impact. To it, aside two. Aside two. I asked the neighbor's 12-year-old kid what his favorite movie was, and he surprised me by saying The Exorcist. I asked him why. He said that, "It was really funny." I know, the kid is a total psychopath, and put three locks on my doors now. But you get my point. Kids these days ain't a scared by that movie no more. But shit, when that movie originally came out, it messed people up big time. Many a critic, academic smart lady has written about how The Exorcist combined the Hollywood budget and art house street cred with exploitation, and heavy on the exploitation. I mean, people lined up to see the thing because they'd heard about Reagan's potty mouth, literal and figurative, the crucifix masturbation, fun at parties, not that I've tried it, no, and spinning head, that I've tried. It wasn't the power of the Christ that compelled you, but gore, baby, gore. You, Karen wags her finger, shouldn't be surprised that the lukewarm parade of PG-13 possession movies of the 2000s never came close to approaching the critical or popular successes of The Exorcist. The Exorcist was a wildly popular event horror film, and one that, unlike its politically progressive, transgressive indie counterparts, Night of the Living Dead, Last House on the Left, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, just happened to be one of the most conservative horror movies ever. Good versus evil. Yay, good! The pure, pristine little white girl saved by white men and religion. Yay, white men and religion. All you need is love! Strike that. Faith! The triumphant return of the status quo. Family values! Heroic middle-classers battling a foreign boogeyman. The demon Pazuzu was literally a brown-skinned foreigner first glimpsed by Father Marin in the movie's opening in Iraq. Yes, much of the possession follows the urtext of The Exorcist and that of other horror films. At times, the reenactment's obviously brazen sameness to classic scenes strikes an innate cultural chord. Yeah, I'm making that shit up as I go. Sounds good, though. Within us, and in a weirdly reassuring way, authenticating what we're seeing. Other scenes are clever and even subtle enough in their deviations from their antecedents to somehow feel new again. Or their antecedents are obscure enough to feel new or new enough. Yeah. Let me break down a bunch of the reenactments. Marjorie stands over Mary's bed, hovering over her sister, which clearly recalls the found footage, Is It a Haunted House or Demon Possession movie, Paranormal Activity. Both camera angles and lighting are similar. Marjorie is dressed just like Katie, wearing boxers and a tight t-shirt. The possession spices up the simple dread of hovering over a sleeping loved one with Marjorie pinching her little sister's nose shut. It adds a layer of sadism that's subtle and hints at possible greater acts of violence. Aside three. Yeah, more politics. Sorry, but it's just so there and waggling in our faces. The reenactment actress playing Marjorie, Liz Jaffe, was no 14 years old. She was 23 and looked it. Marjorie was still a kid. Miss Jaffe was not. Liz had similar hair color, skin tone, etc. to Marjorie, but she was obviously more physically, mature. She wore makeup, tight clothing, and in the masturbation scene, no clothing, but, oh, she had on a few digitally blurred pixels to protect the poor audience from her nasty lady parts. Strike that. The male gaze, please see Laura Mulvey's essay, Visual Pleasure and Narrative Cinema, is in full effect in The Possession at both extremes. The camera ogles a sexualized Liz Jaffe whenever she's on screen. When the real Marjorie is eventually on screen, at the end of the pilot and in the following episodes, she's ogled in a different, though no less demeaning, way. Real Marjorie is an object to be observed, but never too closely, as we, the voyeurs, might find she's a real teenage girl and actually begin to be concerned for her mental health and general well-being. John Barrett represented the valiant struggle of patriarchy in our decaying, secular, post-feminist society, and Marjorie was the withering object of the camera's male gaze. Marjorie projectile vomiting all over her family as they watched Finding Bigfoot. Psst, they never found her. In the living room was an obvious nod to The Exorcist. Maybe not so obvious. The scene is so over the top in its gastric viscera, it recalls the spewing geysers of blood and goo from Sam Raimi's Evil Dead movies, the originals, not the shitty remakes. Marjorie's post-puke, backward crawl, out of the living room, away from the family, and up the stairs is the film negative of perhaps the most famous piece of celluloid to be cut from a film. Regan's contorted spider walk down the stairs in The Exorcist. The special effects in both the show and the movie aren't convincing, and each walk scene suffers because of them. We get a medley of Marjorie performing contortions and linguistic horrors in the hospital and in her psychiatrist's office. The inner demon getting its groove on for the benefit of the men, always men, of reason and science in the white antiseptic hospital room just might be the second most stereotypical scene in a possession movie, with the actual clergy-performed exorcism as number one. The Exorcist, The Rite, The Possession, the 2012 movie by Sam Raimi, featuring a sneaky little Dybbuk hidden in a Jewish wine cabinet box bought at a yard sale, sold. Season 2 of the gory and horny TV series American Horror Story, and you get the idea. Marjorie's psychiatrist, Dr. Hamilton, refused, of course, to be interviewed for the show. Instead, we're treated to creepy witness protection type interviews of orderlies, nurses, and office secretaries. Marjorie's midnight scream fest, the jangling camera running down the hallway after Mary, and Marjorie's wall climb, see the last exorcism, but don't see its dumbass ending. Dipping briefly into the second episode, there's the basement reenactment. Marjorie surprises her sister Mary down in the basement. Her cold, clammy hand lands on Mary's shoulder. She whispers more sweet nothings, strike that, ramblings. Clods of dirt spill from her mouth, cue the eyes rolling white, and then she slowly walks after a screaming Mary up the stairs. Marjorie's long hair hangs down over her face for most of the scene so that she resembles Sadako, the angry spirit of Ringu, or The Ring, and other J-horror films. Okay, yeah, the masturbation reenactment scene. Deep breath. In The Exorcist, it represents the ultimate blasphemy and proof positive that the girl is possessed by an evil spirit, right? A cute, innocent little girl wearing a prim nightgown, BTW, raving like Touretic Louis C.K. and jamming Jesus Christ up her vagina so violently she bleeds all over the place. Score one for Pazuzu, and yeah, we're down that it must be the devil making her do it. So to speak. The Possession's masturbation scene is both more problematic and disturbing. It begins with a camera run from Mary's POV as she opens her parents' bedroom door. It's dark, but we can see Liz Jaffe as Marjorie in profile. She's on the bed wearing only a small black bra. Digital pixelation boxes obscure her buttocks and her hands. The camera switches away from Mary's POV to a straight-on, close-up, loving view of Marjorie's face. The camera pulls back, and there's a series of jump cuts that are so fast we feel like we really can't see much of anything in real time. I've watched this scene with countless friends, and I've asked them what they saw after viewing it in real time, and no two answers are the same, until I slow it down. Going frame by frame, we see the following. Marjorie biting her lower lip, a shadow on the wall of a bedpost, and, can we say, phallus, forearms framing her six-pack abs and navel, open mouth and tongue on her teeth, biceps framing her cleavage, a white inner thigh, blood on white sheets, a wooden cross hanging on the wall, her closed eyes, white forehead and wooden headboard, a bearded male face covered in blood, Satan? A full shot between her legs, dark and pixelated so we can't see her actual fingers in her actual dirty lady parts, strike that, vagina. The bedpost again, only its shadow is larger than it was previously, her knees together, the wooden cross again, totally in shadow. Her feet with curled toes, then, finally, three different shots of blood on the sheets before the camera returns to her little sister, Mary, but not her POV. After the frenetic cuts, we see Marjorie stumbling in the hallway, wiping her bloody fingers, also see the locker room scene in Carrie, on the walls, and we hear her peeing on the floor, but just in case we don't get it, Mary says, "You're peeing on the floor!" Note, Regan peed on the floor in The Exorcist, but it was in a scene separate from the masturbation scene. Marjorie says,
"I can still hear them. They've been here forever."
In a TV speaker's rattling modulated voice that crosses the Cookie Monster with Wicked Witch of the West and the Help Me Man Fly from The Fly. The scene ends awkwardly with the camera POV falling to the floor and on its side as though, just like Marjorie, it has blown its wad. Strike that. Is spent. Marjorie is on the floor, her back to us, buttocks obscured by more pixelation, and Mom and Dad Barrett rush to the hallway and huddle around Marjorie's body. The camera lingers, and its male gaze is conflicted, as it has been during the entire masturbation reenactment scene. It's both titillated and horrified by the natural expression of a teenage girl's body. Intermission. Karen drinks more coffee, must have more coffee! Okay. Now, my favorite reenactments and interviews feature the quieter bits that deviate from the exorcism game plan, but are no less eerie or disturbing. Let's go rapid fire on these because I think the quick accumulation of these nice little moments generates a cool effect. Marjorie's molasses flood story is legit. For a riveting account of the 1919 molasses flood in Boston, check out Stephen Puglio's Dark Tide. Her growing things story was clearly inspired by a short story from a relatively obscure horror writer. Her drawing the growing things on Mary's cardboard house recalls the collected mass of wooden stick figures in the Blair Witch Project, which is not horror's first found footage film, but its most famous. During Marjorie's midnight freakout scene, there's a shot of her bedroom door, which fills the viewing screen, and then the door subtly bows outward. The very same shot, in black and white, is in Robert Wise's amazing 1963 film, The Haunting, which was based on The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson. Marjorie's bit about the voices in her head being so old, ancient, beyond time, and her consonant-heavy speech sound downright Lovecraftian. And, of course, we find out later that Marjorie had been exposed to his work. Cthulhu, for all my friends. Fenglui Mulgwa Nafa Cthulhu Rilie Wagal Nagal Fatagan. Feel free to check my spelling there. Her super creepy spiel to Daddy Barrett about being in heaven and not knowing if your loved one was real or demon was gently lifted from Vladimir Nabokov and his ultimate unreliable narrator novel, Despair. The song Marjorie sings and hums in many of the reenactments, and which the show uses as a theme quite effectively in their background soundtrack, is Gloomy Sunday, originally composed by Hungarian pianist Rezsu Sares in 1933. It's legendary not just because Billie Holiday once sang it, but because it sounded so frowny face sad it supposedly drove a bunch of unsuspecting listeners to suicide. How cool is that? And yeah, I've listened to it like 55 times in a row now, and I'm still here. Keeping all that in mind, in an interview toward the end of the pilot, John Barrett duly informs us that Marjorie claims she never heard of the internet or the library, strike that, doesn't know where she heard the stories, or the song, or where she gets her terrible ideas from. He says that Marjorie has consistently told his family, the psychiatrist, Father Wanderley, the mailman, strike that, and everyone else who ever asked that all that stuff just popped into her head, fully formed, like they were always there. She knew that these were other people's stories, ideas, but swears she hadn't learned of them or heard them from outside sources.
So,
she's precognitive. Or postcognitive. Something cognitive. Gnostic. A priori horror makes us weep with fear. Again, I think this is another brilliant bit. The show had horror fans hooked at hello because, frankly, most of us are not picky. We're like the family dog that wags its tail at a treat, no matter if it's a crappy store brand milk bone or a piece of steak. We, yes, I'm still speaking for you, horror hound, don't mind the familiar and recycled as long as we can consume it without gagging. To the general populace, the recycled bits of classic horror might be naggingly familiar in some recess of their pitiful and atrophied culture lobe of their brains. Brains. But to them, it plays as totally fresh and new and frightening. Aside four. I've got this whole thing about how the possession fits perfectly in the Gothic tradition, but I haven't fully worked it out and I have to save something for later blog posts, right? Right. But I love the idea of all these external influences listed above so obviously affecting the story and affecting Marjorie herself. If she was possessed by anything other than faulty brain chemistry and or DNA, I like to imagine her as being possessed by the vast, awesome, and awful monster that is popular culture. Possessed by the collective of ideas. By the time we finally meet the real Marjorie, and not her Liz Jaffe reenactment stand-in, in the final moment of the pilot, the show has painstakingly built its thematic foundation through realism, through the fears of our deteriorating middle-class and core conservative family values, and through the recycled cultural lessons borrowed or reimagined from the classics of horror literature and film. When we finally see the surveillance-style video of real Marjorie sitting in a room across from an unnamed interviewer, wearing her soccer team sweatpants and sweatshirt, flipping her hair away from her face, revealing her tired, haunted eyes, we're afraid for her, and we're afraid of her. When she says, with her voice cracking, "I'm Marjorie Barrett, and I need help," we shudder. And maybe we giggle nervously, guiltily, but we're hooked. Oh, baby, are we hooked. Cue the pilot outro, which is, of course, in the same minor key of Gloomy Sunday. Chapter 15. Rachel says, "I must say, I'm very impressed by your home, Mary." "Thank you. It is a nice place to rest my weary bones, isn't it?" My two-bedroom condo is a third-floor unit of a South Boston brownstone. The living room's large bay window overlooks Carson Beach, which really isn't much of a beach. I'm told it was at one time. I spend my sunny mornings in the living room with a coffee, a blueberry muffin, and my tablet, and I watch the joggers running parallel to the water and going nowhere quickly. On rainy days, I watch the encroaching, rising waters lash against the helpless seawalls that will no doubt fail one day. "You're much too young for weary bones." We're standing in my living room with the coffees she bought. She's very thoughtful. Outside, it's overcast, and the ocean is sleeping. "That is an amazing view. If you don't mind my asking, what was the asking price? I might be in the market for a condo myself. My daughter is out of the house now, and I don't need all that space." "I don't mind." So I tell her. "Wow." "Yeah, the condo is quite expensive, even with our seasonal flooding issues. It costs $500 a month to rent a parking space in the elevated garage out back. Isn't that ridiculous? But I don't own a car, and I rarely leave my perch, so I'm generally dry."
"You don't go out much for fear of being recognized?"
"No one around here knows who I am or who I was in the context of a 15-year-old television show. Maybe that will change when our best-selling book comes out."
"It's possible that it might. I hope you'll be okay with that."
Rachel doesn't have her blue hat with her. I miss it, fiercely, like one might miss a newly casual acquaintance one hoped would become a lifelong friend. I do like that she's wearing a white button-down shirt tucked into her jeans. Her collar practically has the wingspan of an albatross. I say, "I'll be fine. I have to pay the mortgage somehow, right?"
Oh, Mary, I'm sad to hear that you don't leave your place often. I lead her back toward the kitchen and we sit at the granite-topped, L-shaped counter. I say, there's no reason to be sad. I didn't mean to imply that I'm a shut-in, because I'm not. I have dinner with my aunt twice a month. I go out. I speak to people. I even have a few friends. The last sentence drew